Welcome to Funding Rural. I'm Erin Borla, Executive Director and Trustee of the Sisters Oregon-based Roundhouse Foundation. I also have the privilege of serving as a fellow with the National Center for Family Philanthropy. In philanthropy, we talk about bridging divides. So I want to start things off from the ground up. How do we communicate with one another? When philanthropy works on complex issues, issues like climate, education, food systems, healthcare, and firearms, we're doing so primarily from one perspective. Traditionally, that perspective comes from larger cities where power and wealth is centered, and we're leaving out others who are often closer to these things. Rural people who work on the land or the ocean, who live these things neighbor to neighbor in a way that isn't happening when we're sitting behind a desk. I wanted to dig in on that because words matter, and in a way we have a language barrier between urban and rural, and I see that in the philanthropic world. I asked Elizabeth Moreno to join me for a conversation about this and how it relates to philanthropic work in rural and indigenous communities. Beth is a linguistic anthropologist. She studies the way in which people communicate with one another about divisive issues, and she leads the Laboratory of the American Conversation at Oregon State University Cascades. I'm a huge fan of Beth and her work, and I think philanthropy could learn a lot from her approach to working in rural communities. And just a heads up, after our conversation, stick around and I'll share some of my takeaways. Beth grew up in southwest Louisiana and spent a lot of time at her grandfather's fish camp. She says she's always had a love for small, rural places.
Those rural spaces are just, I think they're interesting. You know, people have this space to be creative, but then they also have a community that keeps them in check. And I think those dynamics of those rural spaces are just really fascinating.
So having grown up in spaces like that, what drew you to academia?
That's a hilarious question because I don't come from an academic family, to say the least, right? I come from a very blue-collar working-class family. I was always interested in education, and I was always interested in books, things like that. I was kind of a science nerd growing up. I went away to college, which was pretty unusual in the town I grew up. But what drew me to graduate school was actually I was working as a journalist in Nome, Alaska, and September 11th happened. And a lot of the people that I was around got called up to the National Guard to go over to Iraq. And one of the things that happened is that people in this primarily Inupiat community of Nome, Alaska, and the surrounding villages were talking about terrorists. And it made me think about, like, what does that word terrorism mean if you're an Inuit Inupiat person in rural Alaska versus if you're sitting in Washington, D.C. And so I started to think about words and language and how that affects how we interpret the world, particularly in communities that are really far away from the centers of power. And I went back to school to get a master's degree in linguistic anthropology, and I ended up studying Inupiat and doing all kinds of work on landscape and language and how we call, like, mountains mountains and rivers rivers, and what different names in different languages we could use to talk about geographical features. But that's what I got back into academia, is just through thinking about how people speak.
There's so much power in language. It's so fascinating. I always love just hearing you speak about those different topics and how different words mean different things to different people. Yeah. And tell me a little bit about that work that you've been doing recently around, like, how people are perceiving messages.
Yeah, so one of the things that's so interesting about language, right, is that we use words and we think we're conveying these small pieces of information, but words have a lot of moral and ethical and cultural value associated with them. So sometimes I think about, you know, that old game, I don't know if you're old enough to have played it, but it's like Minecraft, and you sometimes, like, click on one square and then it opens this whole variety of squares. Words can do that. So what, like, a word like mother or apple pie, or a word like sacred or church or God, or even, you know, dinner time, right, can mean one thing, can convey just a small piece of information to some people, or it can open up an entire, like, universe of moral possibility in somebody else. And so one of the things that I think is so important, especially in this time of kind of divisiveness in the country, right, is that when we're talking to one another, we have to realize that the words we're using can mean a whole host of different things to the communities that we're speaking in. So a lot of the work that we do at my lab, called the Laboratory of the American Conversation, is try to understand how people are conveying their core values, those things that really are emotionally salient to them, those things that they, you know, the hills they would die on. how they convey those sentiments in words and what words they're using to do that, and how an understanding of that emotional weight of the words that we use can either help us have better conversations or can lead to really terrible conversations if we use them incorrectly, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of the work that we're doing right now. We're talking about things like how to protect land and water, how to keep people healthy, how to keep people safe, and to do that in ways that are meaningful.
Can you give us an example? No, I think it's important to hear sort of as we talk about rural and urban issues and how to bring people together, like what's an example of how you would utilize that in your work, or how philanthropy could utilize that in some of these bigger topics? Like what's something that you've worked on that maybe you're seeing our organization or other philanthropists try and work on?
So here's an example from Oregon. I was working on the coast, thinking about marine reserves, which are a policy mechanism to protect state waters, right? And one of the key pieces of communication, science communication, I guess, that was being used on the coast when people were talking about marine reserves and when ODF&W was talking about marine reserves, was to say, the ocean belongs to all of us, right? So I was doing interviews with groups of fishermen and other people that had lived on the coast for a long time, and they would say things like, I've got blood in that ocean, right? And so what I was seeing is this: there was a real butting heads between this idea that the ocean belongs to all of us versus I have a stake in this ocean because I've sacrificed for it, right? And so that what seems like this most innocuous phrase, the ocean belongs to all of us, was really grating against a local value that was, you know, you have to earn a right to that ocean, right? You have to sacrifice something. And we're talking about not insignificant sacrifice, right? I talked to fishers who had lost kids in boating accidents and, you know, just had lost livelihoods when fisheries closed. I mean, these are big sacrifices, right? And so I think about if you're trying to communicate to that group of people, just how you say, we recognize your right to the ocean is different than mine, that your connection to that place, having lived there your whole life or multiple generations, is different than me who comes in from Portland for 2 days a year. You know, so that seems, again, innocuous. It seems like a simple idea, the ocean belongs to all of us. But it was causing these real insults to the communities that lived there. And so by understanding how those value systems work and how those words were being heard by the communities that live there, I think you're able to foster a more helpful dialogue between people that do come in and use the ocean recreationally and people who live there full time.
No, that's super helpful and really paints a picture, right? Because I think that's, especially in philanthropy, right? This show is specifically about how philanthropy can better serve in rural spaces is we often think, we'll just throw money at that problem, or we'll just show up for a day and feel like we understand because we've been there. And that's not the reality. The reality is there are people that are there every day and the struggles are slightly different, and utilizing language that helps them feel like they're a part of the conversation rather than, oh, we know better because we have the power, we have the money, we have the location, whatever that may be, it really seems like where we need to make the biggest shift on the philanthropist side and on the government side too. But I think that's the other piece. So talk a little bit about what excites you about doing this work, especially with rural spaces and frontier spaces.
Well, other than the fact that I like being in these spaces, like I just think it's fun, two things really excite me. One is that in my experience, it is possible to overcome what can initially seem as like an outsider rejection. What I mean by that is when you enter into a rural space or any tight-knit community that has felt ignored or feels distrustful of outsiders, you know, you can initially like feel a kind of tension, like you can initially feel like you're being kept out, right? But it's really amazing in my experience, continuing to show up, showing up multiple times, acting in good faith, keeping your word, that's a big one, you're actually able to overcome these barriers. If you listen to people, if you take to heart what they're saying, if you don't assume that you know better, as you've said, it is possible to make these conversations better. Again, I think there's a narrative in the country right now that you know, we're all very divisive. There are two Americas, that there's no overlap, that we're getting more and more in our bubbles. This is what we hear every day on the radio and in the news, things like that. But I think that those walls between those two Americas are more permeable than we think, and that in some cases, it actually takes very little of a good faith effort to make that barrier burst, right? To create a crack in it and open it up for these conversations to flow back and forth. And so one of the things that makes me hopeful is just the fact that it's been successful, right? So we did, as an example, we did interviews with firearm owners in Eastern Oregon as part of a project on suicide prevention. And this is a project you know very well, but it's a good example of what we're talking about. So in this project, you know, we came in from the academia, two university professors moving into rural Oregon, asking people to talk about their guns. And people were really, at first, very distrustful of our project. They thought they thought we had an agenda. They thought there was a kind of set narrative that we wanted to tell. And we walked into these focus groups, and we really were open. We were asking people, what does your firearm mean to you? How do you see community intervention and suicide prevention strategies working in your community? What do you want to see? What do you want your doctor to know about your gun? All those kinds of questions, you know. And we listened to people, and we took what they said to heart. And at the end of that project, you know, people were really receptive of the suicide prevention strategy that we came up with, and, you know, or that we all came up with together. They were excited about the research. They were interested in the kind of scientific products that we put out. They were interested in hosting us again. It just opened up this really interesting and impactful conversation, you know, that now is trying to be replicated both in Washington and in Minnesota and other research projects. But one of the things that's just so hopeful is that it works, that just a little bit of empathy, some understanding that cultural values can be different, and some awareness of the language you're using goes a long way in breaking down what can be talked about as an, you know, unbreachable barrier or something. Just these, yeah, like I said, those two Americas that are kind of spinning off.
We've talked in the past about equity and what that looks like. And I think just that phrase that I've heard you use before about being distant from power is so powerful when we talk about equitable distribution of resources. Talk a little bit about what your thoughts are in that space.
I love that question, just because I think it's really important. So one of the things that anthropology thinks about is just normative assumptions about the way the world works, and conversations about diversity and equity often talk about this, right? So what we think is the people in power, it's not even that they're trying to be oppressed, they're not even like an intentional oppressive decision, right? But they have assumptions about the way the world works, and those get embedded in the decisions that they make. So most power centers are urban centers, right? Most power centers are also white, and they're also male. So there are a set of normative assumptions that are involved in these characteristics of the people in power that then get built into those decisions. So if you're distant from power, or if your lifestyle doesn't look like the people making decisions, then there are all kinds of ways that your world works that doesn't line up to governance or policy or even like technology or engineering solutions, things like that. So I just feel like it's really interesting to try to think about building flexibility into any program, whether that's a governance program or a philanthropic program, because it's hard to know what you don't know, right? It's hard to know how people's lives work outside of your own. But what you do know is that people's lives are working outside of your own, that they can be look really different than the way that you get up and live your life every day. And so in rural spaces, I was thinking about this on the way over. We were talking about gun policy, and one of these, the story that comes back to me all the time when I think about the suicide prevention research, and when I think about how it interfaced with some of the research on environmentalism that we do, is, you know, right now, if you think about typical environmentalist narratives and the way that we, even scientists, measure environmentalist attitudes, they're very often framed in kind of a liberal value system. So they're often framed thinking about values like care, concern for the world, and a kind of a justice bent. And that's powerful. That really resonates for a certain group of people. But rural communities tend to focus more on values like responsibility, like competency, values that are, like freedom, like purity, these kinds of ideas. And so, you know, so it looks like when we look at these measures of environmentalist attitudes, that it's mostly urban communities or urban communities have greater environmentalist values than rural communities. But I was in these interviews one time, and I was talking to somebody who keeps a firearm in their truck specifically to be able to, if a deer gets hit on the highway and that deer is suffering, that you are able to not watch that deer suffer, to kill the deer so that it wouldn't suffer. And I just thought, like, there is not, there, that takes so much gumption, and like you feel a kind of responsibility to the world around you that's so profound if you take it upon yourself to do that. Like, it's a kind of literal taking on the suffering of the world, right, as your own personal responsibility. And so I just wonder how we can talk about environmentalist attitudes that includes that, right? Mm-hmm. That is actually also a very profound kind of environmentalism. That just demonstrates such a profound kind of respect, I guess, for the animals that you live with. And I think that the important part of firearm conversation is just that we are having it so badly. That a gun is one of those words that means universe of things, right? It is absolutely, a gun is absolutely a cultural construct. Like, there is, it is so, it means, it is a symbol of so many different things in this country, and we are just not able, we are pretending we are talking to each other, and we are not. Mm-hmm. We are just espousing our own view of what a firearm is back and forth.
Well, I think we can use that same sort of logic and talk about climate, right? Yeah. We've weaponized language like climate, like justice.
Yeah.
When the reality is those are just words. But so I think there is an opportunity to bridge divide by getting on the ground and knowing one another as a human, human to human interaction.
Yeah.
So what that means in the world of philanthropy is like getting out from behind our desk, showing up in spaces. Right. And then actually listening, right. Yeah. We don't know better.
Yeah.
And so how do we take language that's become weaponized and transition that to have these bigger conversations? And it doesn't necessarily have to be about one specific topic. But I think you've phrased before, I use it all the time, but like, I've never met a fisherman that wants to fish the last fish.
Yeah.
Right? I love that. And so how do we talk about really honoring the knowledge and power around these incredibly divisive issues? And just change our frame, right? Yeah. So what do you, help us out, help us do that.
Today,
in 20 minutes.
Yeah. I laugh sometimes. I think America's really bad at understanding culture. Like America, I mean, this is probably not what you were thinking about, but as a country, we have a mythology of the melting pot, right? Like we're all going to come together and we're all going to become basic rational humans, right? And there was this sometimes intentionally desire for people to leave their histories in the past, right, and walk forward into kind of a just this rational American citizen. And I think having an understanding of culture is really important because it teaches you that somebody can be very different than you, that somebody can have a different value set, that somebody can live in a different world, use different words, and still, you know, and you're just aware that that is probably true. Nobody assumes, like nobody in France thinks that people in Germany are exactly like them, right? But somehow people in urban California go to rural California and expect everybody to kind of like be just like them, right? So how we get past this kind of divisiveness to how we listen to each other, I just think it takes a lot of open-mindedness and empathy. And, you know, I was thinking about there are these extreme examples, right? So we have like examples of people that were in a hospital dying of COVID and saying that COVID didn't exist. I've heard that narrative or that anecdote told all the time as an example of how stupid people in America are, right? Like just this heavy judgment about how dumb everyone is. And another way to think about that scenario is to think about what is that person in the hospital dying trying to protect that's so important to them that they can't believe their doctor, that it's easier to believe that their doctor's lying to them than to give up whatever they're trying to protect. And that's a good question. If we want to know like how to go forward, asking that question sincerely, what is that person trying to protect, is the right question. Instead of thinking, why is that person so ignorant, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the answer is what they're trying to protect is probably, a way of life and a sense of freedom and the capacity to judge for yourself information, feeling of getting hoodwinked. I mean, that's a feeling that probably all of us are familiar with, whether it's being hoodwinked by, a corporation or a bad, a bad educational experience or whatever, we're just, I think, thinking about what, one of the things that we used to always say is like, people are very rarely trying to hurt themselves, right? They're instead, what people are doing is that they're doing some kind of risk analysis and they're coming up with a conclusion that they think is protecting them from something. So just being empathetic to those kinds of conversations is really important.
The takeaway that I had was, we need to stop thinking about ourselves in the moment of like, my mission is to do this. So you also should want to do this. And here's how I'm going to gift you the thing to do the thing I think is important. If we take the I narrative and the organizational narrative out of the conversation and we say, what are you trying to do, especially in these communities that have not been heard for so long or have been told that they're stupid or ignorant, but really are true the true knowledge holders, especially when we work with our Indigenous partners? How do we have those conversations and train ourselves to take the I away? And I think that's the biggest thing. And it's listening. And I always joke because I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to go to another listening session. There has to be some sort of activity, like action at the end.
Yeah.
Because I think philanthropy is really good at listening or saying they're listening, but we come back to our mission. Well, we heard what you said, but we still think we need to do it this way. So how do we take that narrative and say, okay, we heard what you said. Here's an immediate response to try and fix something or be present with you. And then let's look at the bigger picture, right?
One of the things that's really exciting in academia is this notion of co-produced research. It would be interesting to think about the equivalent in the philanthropic world, actually. So co-produced research is the idea that recognizing that people do hold knowledge, they are experts in their own lives. Researchers partner with communities. I've done work in Indigenous communities in this way, but partner with communities and think about even creating the research questions in collaboration, thinking through how you share research funds that in ways that are equitable, thinking about paying both a scientist and a community-based knowledge holder in equitable ways, and then seeing what kind of knowledge is produced that way and products, right? Like what comes out from a project like that. I don't know. Is there anything like that in the philanthropic space? There has to be.
I mean, I think people are trying. There's trust-based philanthropy, which is like, oh, we're gonna work with these organizations. We're gonna general operating support, long-term support, and just show up. But I do think there's still an important piece of being present as a partner, because oftentimes it's more than the check, right? And it's not just, hey, thanks for the money. That's this, Band-Aid on a head wound. What I really need is I need my story told to be able to leverage additional partnership from the federal government to fix our water system or those other things. It's how do we tell that story from a philanthropist perspective to bring community together on a broader scale and elevate those stories? So I think there's movement there, but it's still really difficult. I think there's a fear almost of getting out and being present and closer to the work. Mm. And I'm not sure where that fear comes from. But I think there, and maybe that's me interpreting that as fear, but that's definitely not the way that we've been working. We try and get out to community and really hear what the need may be, because oftentimes they think it might be one thing. And the reality is, how about we try this other thing first and then work on that next project? And it's just been really interesting to watch that dynamic and hear the feedback from that. I had somebody ask earlier about what's the most exciting thing? And it's the fact that I have grant partners calling me and telling me, I'm in crisis, I need help, what do I do? They feel comfortable enough to have that dialogue. Or I had this amazing success and I want you to share it with me. Could you come to this celebration? So that opportunity, it's more than like, hey, here's my report, thanks so much, check box. It's this interpersonal connection back and forth. And I think that's part of being in rural too, right? Yeah. Is building relationship. So I think that piece has been, I'm hopeful again in that space, but it's hard work and you carry a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, so interesting, right? There is a definite parallel in research, which is that, you know, there's this feeling that if you get too close to the communities that you're working with, that you're now a biased observer. Right, that you can't be neutral and that you can't like carry out scientific research in a condition of neutrality. And you know, I think anthropologists in particular, but other researchers have started to question that construct. It was funny, I have a good friend that was doing a podcast just a couple days ago, and he talked about the fact that and when he read my book, it was the first time he'd ever seen an anthropologist use the term friends when they were talking about their research participants, right? And he was talking about how that was really important for him. And he started to use that term when he was talking about his collaborators as well, because that was the accurate one. He'd been in this community for years, like they were friends of his by now, you know, and that he felt it didn't impede his ability to do analyses, right, or do robust analyses, but it enabled him to know what the impact of that analysis was actually going to be. And I think what you're saying is the same thing, right? It's one thing to be able to say, I think that there's probably a sense that in philanthropy that you don't want to get too close because then you could be biased, or you could just like, I don't know, only invest in your friends or something. But the reality is that unless you have these really personal relationships, you don't even know what the impact it's going to be, right? Or what you just get closer to kind of understanding the whole ecosystem, you know, sociocultural ecosystem that people live in. And then you can see all the threads that work will have, you know, all the impacts that are harder to anticipate unless you can have an honest conversation with people. So I just think that's really interesting. And I wonder if that'll be, I think that is a positive evolution in science and the social sciences. And I wonder how that will happen in your field too. And I do think this is the rural nature of that, or it's just interesting to have these conversations about rural spaces too. Like, so a lot of our work that we do at the lab, we think about how to communicate small things. I gave the example of talking about marine reserves, like how you can actually make communication, a communication strategy more resonant with local values. But over the long term, we're trying to change the narrative. Full scale, right? And so for example, what do we think about actually thinking about rural communities as stewards of this enormous landmass, right? That is North America, the United States of America, however we want to make those divisions. Like rural communities are engaging every day with the lands and oceans that we want to protect from climate change. It absolutely is true that they know those spaces better than the people sitting in DC or New York or Boston or LA that are making policy, right? And so in the short term, we can have a better communication strategy. We can listen more closely. We can do that acute care, right, to make conversations go better. But in the long term, we need to start thinking about a way that we nationally develop a set of ethics that respects the work that rural communities do in protecting the lands and waters that they know best. I really think that, yeah, that has a lot of possibility for addressing problems like climate change. And right now, we're almost doing the opposite. Right? We're almost demonizing those people that live in rural spaces as the ones that are the problem when we think about climate change. And that is at best, that is, you know, an unbalanced narrative. And at worst, it's just an intentional displacement of guilt, right?
Yeah. Oh. Well, oh my goodness, we've covered all the things, I think. So thank you for spending time today and chatting and going through all these things. I always love talking through with you. All of your work is fascinating. I just learn so much every time that we talk about just language, and it's always fun to just bat around different concepts of like, how could we really change the world, right? It's just, it starts with us. It starts with one. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Erin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for tuning into this first conversation. Beth and I talked about a lot of things. One of those that I want to emphasize is taking the I away from our philanthropic practices. We're not superimposing our own values. Whether we believe it or not, we bring our own value system to every conversation and every table that we show up to. So we may think that we know what's best, but ultimately, someone else may have a completely different perspective. And so having a chance to really listen, deeply listen, not talking and waiting to talk, but really talking and then listening to what folks are saying, will allow us a little glimpse into someone else's reality and understanding of their community and its needs. I think a way that Roundhouse is trying to do that is by showing up in those places, making that drive, getting to those really distant and far remote communities that don't see funders. We've heard, hey, you're the only funder that's been here in 3 years. That seems like a real issue within the philanthropic community, is by being present. Beth brought up co-created research, research that's developed in collaboration with subjects and community. I wonder how that can be supported in philanthropy, even in our philanthropic practices. I think we can look at trust-based philanthropy as a real starting point for that. How do we approach that when funders show up in more than just writing a check? We help tell the story. We help elevate different partners and projects. We share things with other funding partners and really try and build relationship. I think lastly, I want to make sure we talk about what she mentioned around that fear of getting too close. I think funders have that same fear, and I really think we need to get over it. We ultimately came together and thought, gosh, if I get too close and I know this person or I know this organization, then I have to say no. That's a really hard thing to do. But if we start from the very beginning and get to know someone and tell them up front, hey, not everything's going to be in our wheelhouse. We're going to find ways to work with you, but not everything's going to be a winner. So I want to listen to all the different things that you have to share and make sure that any of our partners that might be interested or that might be able to work with them and not doesn't work with us, we're going to connect you with those folks as well. So being able to understand that on both sides, not everything is going to be a yes from the get-go, but it's a yes and or a no but, all those different things. Thanks so much for listening to Funding Rural. We talked about a lot of Beth's research and her book during this episode. I'll make sure to have links to all of those things, including a transcript of the episode at fundingrural.com.